This is a short video on Christopher Dresser. He gets his own spotlight partly because I just really like his work, and any chance to look at it is fun, partly because I think there's a lot for designers to learn by looking at his work, and partly because he doesn't really fit into any of the other obvious categories. Christopher Dresser wrote, "At the very outset, we must recognize the fact that the beautiful has a commercial or money value. We may even say that art can lend to an object a value greater than that of the material of which it consists, even when the object be formed of precious matter, as of rare marbles, scarce wood, or silver or gold." That's 1873, and I think the earliest written statement that art and design matters, that what artists and designers do, in addition to other stuff, is take raw materials, which have an entry-level value, and transform that by adding intellectual content. So he's saying art and design matters, and I think that's exciting to hear. The arts and crafts movement is necessary to learn about and learn from, and such a big part of what we still need to be sorting out about the relationship between design and making things using industry. But if we agree that the machine is here to stay and enables design, we have to refocus our conversation on how to learn to use it well and how we began to learn to use it well. And Christopher Dresser is a great person to help us have that conversation. Is he the first industrial designer? I often give credit to Josiah Wedgwood for that because he considered so many of the parts of the equation of what industrial design is. The difference is he had his own factory. So it could be argued that he was actually more a savvy businessman than he was a good designer. Christopher Dresser did not have a company or a factory. He was an independent contractor. He was a contract designer for industry, and he worked with over 50 different companies. Went in, saw what they could make, left them with better ideas about what else they could be making. And for me, that's the sort of ultimate essence of industrial design. In 1899, The Studio, a magazine in London, described Christopher Dresser as the most meaningful industrial designer who turned his imagination and gift of discovery to the daily production of British industry. The powerful efforts of Mr. Dresser to raise the national design standard, to which end he did not create costly individual objects, but instead turned to products for the middle class, indeed objects which would benefit the general public and which deserve every recognition. So it's not just that he designed beautiful things, lots of people have done that. He was intentionally trying to design more affordable, beautiful things. Instead of leaving the divide between expensive things that get design and inexpensive things that don't, he was trying to crosswire those two existing realities. Dresser was born in Scotland, and he studied botany. Remember, in the 1840s and 50s, there was no way to study design. It wasn't a thing yet. It wasn't a profession, and it certainly wasn't something taught in schools. Studying nature is the next best, maybe even better, method of understanding how to build things, how to construct things. These are diagrams that he created in 1854 as a lecturer in botany, before PowerPoint and Keynote, before slides. Professors used to have to draw their images on a big board, and his now live at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. They're remarkable to look at because they may be explaining intrinsic growth and nature, but they also look like the beginnings of beautiful decorative patterns, and that's where Christopher Dresser lived in his work, especially his early work. All of his pattern making, and later his three-dimensional forms, rest on an understanding of how nature creates things, intrinsic growth. He used this knowledge of botany to construct patterns and design objects and materials with visual integrity. He called this art botany, using nature and botany to create art. And he used his art botany to create patterns for wallpaper, to apply to ceramic objects and tiles. At the beginning of his career, some of these were much more literal. It was nature turned into a geometric repeat. Very much the way William Morris was using flowers and geometry to create remarkable wallpapers. But as his career advanced, his ability to make patterns that referenced nature, that learned from nature, but took on a whole new kind of energy and abstraction, got really sophisticated. Dresser wrote, "If plants are employed as ornaments, they must not be treated imitatively, but must be conventionally treated or rendered into ornaments. A monkey can imitate, man can create." Look at the energy in the image on the right, those explosive lines, the curves that have stored energy and then release that energy to help you follow along with your eye and sort of enjoy the changing speed of the ride. He wrote, "I have employed such lines as we see in the bursting buds of spring when the energy of growth is at its maximum." This isn't an accident that he could draw lines full of energy and images full of motion. It's because he was looking at how that happened in growth. Some of these patterns made an obvious natural translation onto ceramic surfaces. So that same drawing, the one that's so full of energy, could be used to activate the surface of a simple cylinder and transform it into something way more elevated. Some of these patterns, the more literal ones, were a perfect mate early in his career for the ceramic shapes made by the company Minton. He went to work for them in 1867 and stayed through the 1870s. It's most likely that he created patterns for existing shapes, and some of those patterns are relatively simple or straightforward, and some are startlingly complex. You can already see in his work for Minton his interest in Japanese motifs. This was very much of its time. The West was looking to Japan for inspiration, and it became an obsession. But you can also see in these interpretations that they're pretty literal. It's like a Japanese motif slapped on a piece of ceramics made in England, or the idea of a Japanese motif slapped on some ceramics made in England. They're a little bit cartoonish. Over time, his work became more authentic. It seems like he was trying to make things that seemed more actually Japanese instead of cartoonishly Japanese. He was aware of the outsiderness of what he was doing. There are few available records about his work at Minton. The drawings weren't all signed, so it's pretty evident which things he made, but there isn't a great paper trail of that. But it's likely that the earliest pieces he made were actually on view at the 1867 Paris Exposition. So that attaches his design career to a pretty early starting date. He designed for lots of other materials. He worked for many manufacturers in all different materials. His metalwork, I think, is so interesting to look at. And he created this metalwork for a bunch of manufacturers, but also a bunch of different markets. There's high end made of sterling silver, and there's lower end using electroplating to put silver onto a base metal like brass or nickel. So similar shapes might be available as expensive items or more affordable items. The work he was making at this time is unlike anything else being made anywhere. Was it his interest in botany that allowed him to do this? Was it his interest in efficient manufacturing techniques? Was it his interest in creating affordable wares that distinguished what he was doing from the other efforts that were pursuing higher end opportunities? Was it his interest in traditional Japanese vessels and forms? Whatever the reason, probably a combination of all of these, his forms look so modern. They look like something that could have been made in the 1930s or 60s or 80s or today. Also, his work lived right at the edge of technology. Electroplating silver onto metal didn't happen before the 1840s. Before that, you could laminate silver onto another metal mechanically and then form it into something. But to make an entire vessel out of nickel or brass and then plate a layer of silver onto it started in the 1840s, originally with battery power, so small scale, but then with the advent of electricity, that could be scaled up to a larger industry. So this work was really exploring the newest of technologies at the time. He was incredibly prolific. Every time I feel like I might not have accomplished enough during the day, I try not to think about Christopher Dresser. All of his forms are insanely inventive and unlike anything I could imagine or anything I could find in a history book for you. When you see something that looks like Christopher Dresser designed it, it's because he did. They're completely undecorated. And remember, everything else made at this time was decorated surfaces. That was the whole sort of outcome of industrialization, the ability to put more texture on stuff to define its value. So everything was textured. Christopher Dresser's things were not. At the same time, there are so many small details to learn from. If you ever need to attach a handle to a big volume or a spout or feet or a big thing to a small thing, look at the way he's done this. By looking at nature, he's understanding branching structures. He's understanding how a petal comes off of the central connector point of a flower and using that information to make manufactured objects. So what I call the Dresser foot under most of his teapots is sort of a cylinder that flares out and then has a little return before it attaches to the bigger object. You might look at that and say, that's just the thing he slapped on everything. He only had one idea about feet. Or you might look at them more closely and see how much variety there is in the way he did that. But it's a really effective way to add a small thing to a big thing in a way that seems intentional and considered. None of this is accidental. The three images on the top and on the right are from Dresser's Principles of Decorative Design, and they show section drawings of vessels where he's considering the position of the handle, the weight of the liquid, how that transfers as you pour something. So there's lots of thinking about how the shape will perform as well as what it looks like. I put the drawing in the bottom at the left in to remind me to point out that there are also hidden details in Dresser's work that you can't appreciate visually. Many of his teapots have a relationship between the finial, the thing on top, and the handle. In this case, when you open the lid, that finial, which has flat surfaces, rests on the flat surface of the top of the handle in a really satisfying way that says, yes, now I'm in my open position. He also produced work that was glass and metal, crystal and electroplate, crystal and sterling. That's worth looking at because it has the same sort of exaggerated shapes that also managed to be elegant, that also managed to be functional. He did a sneaky thing. As a contract designer, of course, he was looking for ways to maximize his profit. So you can find work made by different manufacturers that are a little bit similar. In this case, egg-shaped teapot. But if you look closely, everything about these egg-shaped teapots is different in detail. The basic concept, egg-shaped teapot, is the same. Handle's different, spout's different, finial's different, feet are different, all different. So it's like he developed 75% of the DNA of a teapot and then sold it to multiple people with 25% new stuff added to it, which is really smart. Because so much of his work was electroplated, it could also exist in unplated form. So if they were made out of brass and then silver plated, they could also be sold just as brass. And that increased what a manufacturer could make without increasing what it cost to make any of that stuff. I like lining up all the versions of something I can find because at first they all seem like the same thing. There's another one. But then when you look, they're actually all different. Different metal combinations, different handle location, different handle shape. It's really fun. It's like a treasure hunt or a spot the difference puzzle. Again, his work was unlike other stuff being made at the time. Everybody else was exploring mechanization and industry as a way to add detail, and Dresser was looking to it as a way to remove detail and celebrate the more inherent qualities of what an object could be. I can't stress enough how alien these things were at their time, even today, and yet they were tremendously successful because he was concerned with making them affordable. This is especially evident in work he did for companies like Richard Perry, where the metal is enameled or painted. So there's not any decoration at all. It's just a bold sort of statement of two colors and a form. By this point, Dresser was so well known and so well regarded that his name was being attached to everything he made. We're familiar with that as a marketing scheme today. Thank you, Martha Stewart. But it's been going on for a much longer time. In the 1930s, when industrial design became a sort of celebrated profession, designer names started getting slapped on everything. But way back in the 19th century, this was happening with Dresser's work, and I don't know of anybody else at the time who had that level of sort of renown or success as a designer. I also just find myself sort of laughing or smiling when I see his work, because so much of it is just amusing and funny and full of personality. There's a lot to learn from that, because in today's world, you know, we have lots of things that look like a little character. We slap eyeballs on things. We make little smiles and crazy hair on our tools because we want them to be cute. Dresser was so much more sophisticated about this. He understood that cute has a value to us emotionally, but can take over a piece. So how cute and funny can something be, but still be a serious piece of tableware? The thing on the upper right, I think it was made as a nut dish, I'm not totally certain, is so ridiculous and wonderful. It's the simplest to form. It's a cone with three little legs. They're not little legs, they're huge legs. And it, to me, it just says, try and get the peanut. I'm going to run away from you, right? It looks like it's going to skittle across the table at any time, full of energy. This piece was made around 1885, and again, electroplated nickel, so relatively affordable. It was reproduced in 1991 by Alessi, the Italian tableware company, as a high-end piece of sterling silver, and then as a more affordable plastic version. And I found this fascinating because Dresser couldn't have predicted what plastic would do to affordability, but it looks like he did, right? He made something that is perfectly suited to being molded out of plastic, And now the amount of fun this thing offers is matched by its price. What was interesting at the time when this came out was, I don't remember it being marketed as a piece of old design. I don't remember anybody saying, this thing's 100 years old, enjoy. It was marketed as a new Alessi product. They did call it the Christie Bowl and sell it as a sugar bowl, but I don't think the packaging referenced Dresser in any way. Dresser also wrote a lot, and his ideas are wonderful and worth encountering. His language use is challenging. It's dense, it's complicated, it's very of its time. So I want to read this to you because it's a really great idea. Bear with me. A wise policy induces a country to draw to itself all the wealth that it can, without parting with more of its natural material than is absolutely necessary. If for every pound of clay that a nation parts with, it can draw to itself that amount of gold, it is obviously better thus to part with but little material, yet secure wealth, than it is to part with the material at a low rate, either in its native condition or worked into coarse vessels, thereby rendering a great impoverishment of the native resources of the country necessary in order to increase its wealth. So that's like 110% language for 84% content, but that 84% content is beautiful. What he's saying is, if you have natural resources, let's say clay, and you sell that clay to someone else to make stuff with, you're missing an opportunity to monetize your resources, because if you transform them into a vessel that you can sell for way more than the clay is worth, that's what you should be doing. So the basic idea here is not just artists and designers are adding value. Artists and designers are a financial business force that can transform something from a low value to a high value by infusing it with the spirit of innovation and creativity. It's not just saying artists and designers are okay, or artists and designers matter. He's saying artists and designers are supremely important. That's really exciting to hear. So it's worth getting through the language to pull out that idea. And that again is from 1873. Dresser designed things for Coalbrookdale, which is the company that pretty much launched the Industrial Revolution by transforming what iron could be made into. And his work is very like other Coalbrookdale Victorian cast iron pieces in that it's honoring what the material does. It flows through a sand mold, making a sort of lace network of shapes. But unlike other Victorian cast iron furniture, it's not literal leaves and ivy plants turning into a bench. He's using art botany again to create really wonderful rigid geometry of a repeat pattern out of nature and out of cast iron. Dresser's work got even more essential and bold and exciting and experimental when he started working in ceramics. A new company called Linthorpe Pottery was forming, and he became the art director there. He was there from 1879 to 1882, and his work for Linthorpe is a real triumph in understanding form as the most important aspect of a vessel. He was looking to some older cultures. He was looking at Japanese forms, and clearly he was looking at South American, Mayan, or Aztec forms, but he was also blending these all together to become something more contemporary. And although Linthorpe did glaze all of these with some pretty remarkable glazes, it really is the shape that distinguishes these objects. And you can see his name molded right into the bottom because, again, Christopher Dresser was well-regarded and well-known. After Linthorpe, Dresser designed for William Ault Pottery, from 1893 to 1896. And this work is even more, I don't know, wacko. I don't know if it was Dresser's maturing interest in crazy glazes or that William Ault had a larger arsenal of options with glaze. I'm not certain. But I think you can see that now we have those really impressive shapes covered in even more impressive, bordering on insane, glaze applications. For James Cooper, Dresser designed a really wide range of glass shapes called Cultha vases, named after an area in Scotland. And these are an intentional reaction against other glass that was being made at the time. High-end cut crystal was very expensive, and you make it more expensive by having more cuts and more polishing and more angled geometry applied to its surface. And then glass was being molded to try and copy that less expensively. Dresser didn't want to make anything like that. He was looking instead at antiquity, at Venice and Rome and Egypt, and trying to come up with colors and combinations and shapes that replicated ancient glass. That's very much like what Louis Comfort Tiffany was doing in America with his Tiffany Studios and Fevrille glass. In spite of the fact that I find his writing cumbersome, Dresser was a prolific author. He published many books, early in his career on botany, explaining nature, later in his career on design and how to use botany as a design tool. And one of his books has become one of my favorite things to suggest that designers read, or anyone for that matter. It's 571 pages long, so I don't actually think anybody will read it, or maybe should read it. It's called Japan, Its Architecture, Art, and Art Manufacturers, published in 1882. And it has two halves. The first half is a travelogue of his trip to Japan, and the second half is observational record of how things were being made in Japan in the 1870s. Japan was a sealed nation, closed from the West until the 1850s, so there were centuries of craft traditions still alive in Japan. When Dresser saw things being made, he realized how much had been lost in the industrialized world in terms of shared knowledge about how to do things. Industry had made some things easier and better and more efficient, but many of the techniques we had given up to arrive at industrialization had some value, and Dresser wanted to help us understand that. I'm assuming you're not going to read this book, so I want to share a couple of quotations that bring its content to life, but also help you hear Christopher Dresser's voice in a way that I think is satisfying. Dresser wrote, "This is our traveler's resting place, and here we have our dinner. But to our sorrow, most of the sandwiches which we brought with us have disappeared. And what remains in the way of provisions is chiefly a pot of jam. It was a happy thought, putting that pot of jam in the basket. For in most places, rice can be got for money, and although poor rice, boiled in water, scarcely forms itself a satisfactory meal, jam gives it a relish and makes it, at least, palatable. Very often, since the time of which I now write, I have made a meal of only jam and rice." Dresser was in Japan for 4 months. He was sent there as a representative of the South Kensington Museum, which is now the Victoria and Albert. He started at the end of December 1876, and he had a rare privilege. He was allowed inland from the port cities, which was the sort of border for all Westerners visiting Japan at the time. He had special permission to travel inland to make his observations, and he traveled over 2,000 miles. He was one of the very first Westerners to examine and record, and then as a result through his publication, share the traditional crafts and fabrication methods in use in Japan. On the way to Japan, he toured the United States, and he lectured about design, and he also picked up an extra commission. So he already had one job to go to Japan for the South Kensington Museum, but then he was hired by Londros and Company in London, who was a wholesale supplier to Tiffany, to collect Japanese objects for Tiffany. So he assembled a collection of traditional and contemporary Japanese objects to send back to Tiffany in New York, which at the time was looking for different things to resell and trying to cash in on the interest in Japanese goods. He sent over 2,000 objects back to Tiffany, most of which were resold at auction, but some of which also formed a reference library. So if you look at Tiffany metalwork from the 1880s and 90s and beyond, there's a strong presence of Japanese art and design in the motifs that are used. Those came from objects that Dresser sent back. Edward C. Moore, who is design director at Tiffany, built this archive of Japanese objects so his designers could be more authentic in the things they were copying. If you're going to appropriate, do it well, I guess. Many of those objects wound up in his personal collection and are now at the Met in New York City. So you can trace Japanese objects in the Met to Edward C. Moore, to Tiffany's design collection, to the objects they made, and then I continue that tracing back to Christopher Dresser in Japan. I also am borderline obsessed with the million pagodas from Japan made by Emperor Shikotu that are evidence of the earliest movable type printing in Japan, using separate characters together to transfer ink onto paper to produce scrolls. It blew my mind when I encountered in Christopher Dresser's book this quotation. "We were about to bid our host adieu when he begged us to return to the building where we saw the oldest of the treasures, as here there was a small object which he desires me to accept. This he terms a pagoda, but in reality it is a turned piece of wood, some 6 inches in height, with a base and discs protruding horizontally, one above the other. It is hollow, and the orifice is closed by a pear-shaped wooden stopper. But the great interest of this little object lies in its containing a specimen of the first printing ever effected in Japan." So Christopher Dresser owned one of the million pagodas. Dresser already had one job to go to Japan. He picked up another job to send stuff back to New York from Japan. When in Japan, he got another job, which was to prepare a report for the Japanese government on trade with Europe. The Japanese government wanted to be better positioned to sell stuff to Europe, to choose better things, to manufacture better things. And Dresser was bold. He was critical to the government of their approach. They believed they should be making Western goods, modern goods, industrial goods, just using their material and their skills to make things that looked like Western objects. And Dresser, as you might imagine from the quotation I read to you, saw that there was a better opportunity to use their artistic integrity and ability to transform that material into something that was authentically Japanese. And he encouraged them to actually send the things they already made, practical everyday goods, or even their more treasured art and artifacts, but in an authentic Japanese style, not an assumed Western one. It's amazing to me that one person could be so responsible for a cultural exchange between Japan and the outside world, working in both directions from the inside out and the outside in. And he wrote, "I cannot help thinking that the Japanese are right in regarding the man who can make a beautiful pot, a lovely cabinet, a charming fabric, or a perfect netsuki as a being superior to the mere buyer and seller of goods. For while the one devotes his best energies to mere money-making, the other ennobles matter by the impress of his mind, intelligence, skill, and love." You can't get a better statement about what art and design can do than that one. When back in England, Dresser set up a business to import goods from Japan and resell them. He used all of the connections that he made to choose different objects to import. The business wasn't a financial success, but it was important in helping more people see not the goods manufactured intentionally for export, fake Japan, not the goods that the West was making in the spirit of Japan, but actual authentic Japanese objects. The last quotation I want to read for you pairs with this image. "In the great temple of Shiba, we have a development of architecture perhaps equal to anything that has been produced by any people in any age. Why then should we lead a nation, which is in itself great, to adopt new methods by which it can only be made to appear small? Why would we, in an industrialized culture, look to another culture that is beginning to adopt our ways and encourage that, when if you actually look at how they do things on their own, it might be better than anything we could be helping them achieve? There's an arrogance that industrialization introduced to the world, that people who have better technology are somehow better than the people who have less. And we still have those prejudices. Dresser had a humility that allowed him to see past that and actually appreciate what he was encountering in Japan for what it was, not for what it could be turned into. The other thing he did when he got back home was start preparing a book about his travels. This was published in 1882 and is part daily record, travel log, travel journal, and part record of how things were made in Japan. To produce this, he commissioned over 1,000 photographs while he was in Japan and a whole series of colored drawings from native artists to record what things looked like. He then had a Mr. Hundley produce drawings from those photographs, and then someone he credits as Mr. G. Pearson carve those images into wood blocks. So the book is full of beautiful images produced with the same artistic technique used in Japan for reproducing images on paper. The most interesting thing about his trip to Japan is how it changed his own work. Before Dresser went to Japan, he was interested in Japan, as many people were at the time, but as you can see in his work for Minton, it was a surface decoration interest. Pre-existing shapes that were vaguely Japanese, maybe, with motifs that were maybe Japanese. They're all about the surface effect of these objects. But after his trip, he began to focus on form. His work took inspiration from the functional ideas that he encountered in Japan and the combinations of materials and the methods of attaching different parts. So while Victorian England was totally obsessed with using the machine to produce ornamented surfaces, Dresser arrived at a way more sophisticated and I think way sneakier method of using mechanization and serial production to make things with an entirely different level of integrity. This picture I save for last because I think it is the triumph of his ceramic work. It's not even relying on vivid colors or interesting glazes. There's no surface decoration of any kind. And yet it's a fascinating and exciting object that triumphs on the strength of its form alone. That's what Japan allowed Dresser to do. The reason his work is so unique to him and so outside of its time is he was really adept at understanding source material and how to incorporate it. And that's something I think all designers can learn from. There are only three pictures I can find of Christopher Dresser. One of them is from his trip to Japan. Where the rest of those over 1,000 photographs have gone, I'm not sure. I don't know why they're not available. They may be in a museum collection somewhere. I haven't been able to locate them. But I include them here so you can see him at three stops along the way of his career and his life. I gave Dresser his own spotlight, partly because I admire him and his work, partly because he was the first contract designer for industry, but also because he helps us navigate a shift when looking at design history. He falls chronologically into the Victorian era. He was alive in Victorian England. But the next chapter after the Victorian era starts to refocus and look at nature as an inspiration and a source for design work in a new way. That's the Art Nouveau. Most of his work predates that style, and he also lived just outside of its sort of main geographic sphere of influence. But his work, in its incorporation of nature and intrinsic growth, and his looking to the East for guidance and inspiration, predict much of what the Art Nouveau would take on. So in many ways, Christopher Dresser lived before the Art Nouveau, but his work fits in its sensibilities and explorations in that period. So looking at him on his own helps us appreciate both what came before the Victorian era and what came after the Art Nouveau period. Okay, let's hope this time worked because I can't record that a third time.